Turn with me to Proverbs 5:23. This will be the last verse of Proverbs 5. And then after this, we'll get into a whole new topic, which will be nice. Proverbs 5:23. It says, "He shall die without instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray." So we're still talking about the guy that goes into the strange woman. That's what this whole chapter has been about. And it ends with his death, which is, I guess, a pretty good place to end it. That's usually where most things end. So let's look at the first three words there. He shall die. So it makes sense that the man will die, because we're told in Romans 6:23 that the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. So yeah, when you sin, you'll die. And especially when you sin a sin like this, you're certainly worthy of death. We're told in at least a couple, three different places in the book of Proverbs that the man that goes into a strange woman has a death wish. Remember Proverbs 2:19 a while back, we looked at that, where it says, "None that go unto her return again, neither take they hold of the paths of life." So there's, as we talked about, if you'll remember, just by way of very brief review, there's a couple of different ways that the man that goes into her might not return again. He might get killed on the way out, you know, if her husband happens to come home, or he may not return again with the honor that he had whenever he went in to her. He may lose that, and so he comes out a totally different man and different in the eyes of all of his friends and co-workers and family and so on. So a couple of different ways that he cannot return again. And then in Proverbs 7 and verse 23, it says, "Till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare and knoweth not that it is for his life," referring to this young man that went into the woman with the attire of an harlot, the strange woman. It's just as if he was struck through the liver, right? He will die one way or the other. He will get death. And I'll talk about the different ways that can happen. And then verses 26 and 27, it says, "And she shall, for she hath cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death." It's amazing that a woman that's much smaller than a man, much weaker than a man, can easily slay him, right, through this kind of sin. So the different ways that he could die, as we've already looked at, would be disease. Remember Proverbs 5:11, "And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed." So he could die of AIDS or one of the other STDs that can kill you. Or he could die of a vengeful man that doesn't like the fact that he's taken up a bedroom with his wife. Proverbs 6:33 through 35 says, "A wound and dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. For jealousy is the rage of a man, therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom, neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts." Or he could just die at the hand of God. God has been known to kill people before. Remember Ananias and Sapphira? They lied to the Holy Ghost, and God struck them dead right on the spot. Nadab and Abihu, they offered strange fire. We talked about that just on Sunday. God killed them. Onan touched the ark to steady it. God killed him. Uzzah. Oh, God killed Onan too. He got an early withdrawal penalty. And then there was Onan's brother-in-law, or brother, I think. Ur was wicked, and the Lord killed him. And then Onan was supposed to raise up, I think Onan was supposed to raise up seed for Ur, and then he didn't want to. So, yeah, so there's been a lot of people over the years that the Lord has killed, you know, like millions of people in the flood and so on. I mean, God does kill people from time to time. Sodom and Gomorrah, whole city, yes. So anyway, it could just be a direct judgment from God. Remember Hebrews 13:4 that it says, "Marriage is honorable and all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge." And that judgment can be death. And I would not doubt that God has slain many adulterers in the past. Wouldn't surprise me a bit. In fact, I have known people that committed adultery that died earlier than you would have thought they would have. And it wouldn't be surprising to me one bit if that wasn't a judgment from God. It took a long time, but so it does happen. I know of it personally. And if this guy is not a child of God, saved by grace, then he's going to die an eternal death of suffering in the lake of fire. And that's the worst kind. Revelation 21 and verse 8. Revelation 21 and verse 8. It says, but the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers, that's like this guy we're reading about here in Proverbs 5, whoremonger. Did I say it right? Mm-hmm. Whoremonger. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not whoremongerer. I've been saying that wrong forever. Judy told me about it last week. Whoremonger. And whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So yes, this is a death, but this is a death that just keeps on deathing. Like you never get out of it. It just continues. The punishment continues. Jesus said these should go away into everlasting punishment prepared for the devil and his angels. I kind of put two verses together there, but anyway, you get the point. So it said there that he shall die without instruction. Right? He shall die without instruction. Now, how is it that this man is going to die without instruction? Because as we've looked at in Proverbs 5, he was given a lot of instruction. That's the whole point of the chapter, right? The chapter is Solomon giving instruction to not do this, to not commit adultery. But yet it says that he shall die without instruction. Now, how is that possible? Well, he will die without having heeded instruction. Because in verse 12, we see that he certainly did get instruction. And say, how have I hated instruction, and my heart despised reproof? This is the same exact guy that's dying without instruction there in verse 23. So he hated instruction, but yet he did get it. Well, he didn't heed it. That was the thing. He was instructed to stay away from the strange woman by many teachers, including God, parents, the scriptures, pastors, teachers, common sense, right? We talked about all the different ways in which a man is instructed to not commit adultery. There in verse 13, and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined mine ear to them that instructed me. So yeah, he got lots of instruction. So how will he die without it? Well, in James 1, 21 through 22 through 24, we're taught that if you don't listen to instruction and obey instruction, it's just as useless as if you never heard it at all. James 1, 22 through 24. James says, but be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any be a hearer of the word, and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass, for he beholdeth himself, and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. So, if you, like, let's just say you had a very severe case of dementia or Alzheimer's, and you couldn't your short-term memory was totally gone, and you look in the mirror, and then you walk away, and you forgot you looked in the mirror. Was looking in the mirror any good to you? It was no good at all, right? You don't even remember what you looked like. You have no idea. You don't know that you got a big mark on your face and you look goofy, right? Because you can't remember. Well, James says it's the same way, that if you hear the word and you don't do it, so it's worthless. The word is totally worthless if you hear it and you don't do it. So this is how the man will die without instruction. Though he was instructed, because he didn't pay attention and listen to it and obey it, he's dying without it because it's totally worthless to him. So therefore, a man who refuses to heed instruction dies without it. And then the second half of the verse. And in the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray. Now, the folly in context is the folly of adultery with the strange woman. Look at Proverbs 5:20. Proverbs 5:20. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman, embrace the bosom of a stranger? And he just got done telling him to only embrace his own wife. So this is a married man, so therefore this is adultery. So the direct context here is adultery. The greatness of his folly is adultery. And adultery is indeed a great folly. It's a folly of great magnitude. Greatness means the attribute of being great in size, extent, or degree. And folly is the quality or state of being foolish or deficient in understanding, want of good sense, weakness or derangement of mind, also unwise conduct. There's nothing greater in degree of unwise conduct, of doing something that where you would want or lack good sense or being deficient in understanding. There's nothing greater than adultery, or I'd say very few things anyway. So much so, and I know I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it to you again. You might have forgotten. In the book of James, James compares adultery and murder. And if you read the order here, it appears, it's in James 2 and verse 11, that he actually puts adultery higher on the scale of sin than he does murder. I know I've mentioned this before. He says, "For he that said, do not commit adultery, said also, do not kill. Now if thou commit no adultery, yet if thou kill, thou art become a transgressor of the law." So you say, so if you commit no adultery, yet if you kill, you're a transgressor. So if you killed, and then your defense is, well, yeah, but at least I never committed adultery, right? You're saying that adultery would actually be the greater crime. So yeah, even though you haven't committed adultery, you killed somebody, that means you're still a sinner. You see the point? So he actually is putting adultery higher than killing somebody. And that's interesting, if you think about it. And I suppose maybe if a guy came in and kills your wife, she's gone forever. If a guy comes in and takes her away from you, and then you have to watch her be with him for the next 20 years, probably worse than if she was dead. Right? So maybe that's why adultery is worse. Just a thought. Adultery is an exceedingly foolish thing to do, and he that does so lacks understanding, just as the definition of folly shows, that it is being foolish or deficient in understanding, and that's what the scripture says in Proverbs 6:32. But whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding, he that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. So it's not only a bodily destruction, it's a spiritual destruction. You'll ruin your own soul. You'll ruin your own inward person. Ruin yourself psychologically, mentally, emotionally. It'll really screw you up. Now, it's interesting when it says, it describes adultery as the greatness of his folly. And that really matches up with what else the scripture says about adultery. Because in Job 31, 9 through 11, adultery is called a heinous crime. Job 31, 9 through 11. Job says, "If mine heart have been deceived by a woman, or if I have laid wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind unto another, and let others bow down upon her. For this is an heinous crime. Yea, it is an iniquity to be punished by the judges. For it is a fire that consumeth to destruction, and would root out all mine increase." He says it's a heinous crime. And this is the only place in the Bible where the word heinous is used. So it's interesting. You kind of see what James is referring to there when he puts adultery above murder. I just think that's kind of curious. A heinous crime is a crime that is hateful, odious, highly criminal or wicked, infamous, atrocious, chiefly characterizing offenses, crimes, sins, or those who commit them. So hateful, odious, highly criminal and wicked, atrocious, those are pretty strong words there. So therefore, adultery is a great sin. And committing adultery will lead a man astray. Remember, in the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray. It will lead a man astray from God. Astray is out of the right way, or out of the right way, away from the proper path, wandering. Away from the right, in or into error or evil. So it'll take you off of the path of righteousness, off of that straight and narrow way, into the way which leads unto destruction. You'll go astray. You'll go away from God if you do that. And it says in Proverbs 7:27 that the strange woman's house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. And that would be a way of saying that you shall go astray. If you go down to the chambers of death, you probably have gotten onto the wrong path. Proverbs 7:27, her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. So the man that goes there goes into error and to evil. That is, goes to the strange woman's house. So that takes care of Proverbs 5:23 and Proverbs 5 as a whole. Turn to Proverbs 6:1. Proverbs 6:1. Start into a new chapter and a new topic. Proverbs 6:1 says, "My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger." So Solomon spent the previous chapter, chapter 5, instructing his son about the dangers of entangling himself with a strange woman. Now he switches topics and warns him to not entangle himself in becoming a financial guarantor for his friend's debt. So I guess these are unrelated in one sense, but there is a relation because they're still becoming entangled in sin, or at least in this case, in a bad idea. So let's look at it first. Let's look at the first part. "My son, if thou be surety for thy friend." Now, I think surety is probably an older word that people aren't very familiar with. At least I wasn't familiar with it in everyday speech before I started reading the King James. Surety is defined as means of being sure. It's a formal engagement entered into, a pledge, bond, guarantee, or security given for the fulfillment of an undertaking. It's also a person who undertakes some specific responsibility on behalf of another who remains primarily liable. One who makes himself liable for the default or miscarriage of another or for the performance of some act on his part. Example, payment of a debt, appearance in court for trial, etc. It's a bail or security. So if you are a surety for somebody else, you are on the hook for their debt. You have agreed that if they can't pay, that you will, that you'll take care of it. In other words, it's like co-signing. It is co-signing for a loan. That is becoming surety. And Solomon is warning us to not do that. Don't do that. So a man that is surety for a friend has put himself under legal obligation to guarantee the payment of his debt or other obligations. A lot of people do this, especially with the co-signing thing. A lot of parents co-sign for their kids, and people do this a lot. And Solomon is telling us here, this is not a good idea. And he tells us, what he's really going to tell us here is, number one, not to do it. But if you were dumb enough to do it, how to get yourself out of it. And you really can't ever get yourself out of it fully, but he's teaching us how to get ourselves out of it without end up being on the hook for the debt. And I will explain as we go through this in the next week or two how that is. It's really interesting. This is quite a fascinating topic, I think. So a man who is surety for another assumes the blame if the obligation is not fulfilled. We see this from Genesis 43 and verse 9. Genesis 43 and verse 9. This was when, you remember, Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt. He ends up in Egypt and eventually ends up being the prime minister of Egypt. And there was the famine in the land, and his brothers went, and he asked them if they had another brother, and they said they did have another brother, Benjamin, which was Joseph's full brother. Joseph and Benjamin were full brothers, and he wanted to see Benjamin again. And so he told them when they came back to bring Benjamin with them. Well, Benjamin was Jacob's, the father's, favorite. Joseph was the favorite. He lost Joseph. Benjamin was his new favorite. They were both the sons of his favorite wife, Rachel. Well, Jacob didn't want to give up Benjamin, and so Judah said that he'd become a surety for him, basically. Genesis 43 and verse 9. Judah says here, "I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, and let me bear the blame forever." So he was going to take it. All the brothers are going back there. They're all taking Benjamin with them. But Judah is the one that's becoming surety. He's saying, if anything happens to Benjamin for any reason, I'm going to take all the blame. That's what it is when you're surety. That's what it is when you co-sign for somebody. You are going to take all the blame if they default. So for the next four verses, Solomon warns his son of the danger of being surety for another's debt, and he exhorts him to do whatever he can to save himself from that obligation. Let's just read the passage. We'll get to it and expound it here in the next week or two. But Proverbs 6, 2 through 5, he says, so this is, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself, when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. So he's telling him how to save himself from it. And it's interesting, because it is an obligation. It is a binding deal. And you just can't say, I don't want to be a surety anymore. You can't. You can't do that. But like if you co-signed for a loan, and then a year later said, you know what, I don't really want to be on this loan anymore. You can't do that. Right, you just can't get out of there. You are legally obligated. So Solomon tells him how to do it in a legal way. Now, a stupid person strikes hands and becomes surety in the presence of his friend. And these aren't just my crude words. This is what God says. Proverbs 17 and verse 18. Proverbs 17, 18. It says, a man void of understanding. That's a way of saying a stupid person, right? A dummy. A man void of understanding striketh hands and becometh surety in the presence of his friend. So his friend is present when he does it. And this fact then implies that the striking of the hands is with a third party to benefit his friend. If you are surety in the presence of your friend, that you're not shaking hands with the friend, you're shaking hands with a third party while your friend is present. And that's what striking hands mean, and we'll get into that here in a little bit. But when you strike hands, you shake hands. It's interesting that shaking hands goes back thousands of years. People have been doing that forever. It's not just something that we do in our culture today. So this is what the remainder of Proverbs 6:1 goes on to say, because he says there in Proverbs 6:1 in the second half, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger. See, surety for the friend, but striking hands with a stranger, shaking hands with a stranger. So a man that becomes surety for his friend is stupid, void of understanding, is what we just saw in Proverbs 17, 18. Why is he stupid? Well, this is a good way to go broke if something happens and your friend can't pay. Right? Proverbs 22, 26 through 27. Because if anything happens to your friend, he loses his job, he falls on hard times, or he's just a bum and decides he's not going to pay because you are, you're on the hook, and you could go broke. And you'd be especially stupid if you were surety or if you co-signed for somebody and you didn't have the cash in the bank to pay up if you had to. Now, normally I would think banks would verify that you actually had the cash or the income to cover it. But you could end up going broke. Proverbs 22, 26 through 27. Be not thou one of them that strike hands, or of them that are sureties for debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee? See, in those days, you don't pay. I mean, they'll just come take your bed. They'll take your house. They'll take everything. And if that doesn't cover it, they'll throw you in debtor's prison. Remember what Jesus taught in Matthew 18? Right? That he would be delivered to the tormentors until he paid the last mite. So, yeah, in those days, there was no bankruptcy court or something like that. You just can't declare bankruptcy and go on. No, you're going to pay, and then you're going to go and work for somebody, and you're going to pay it off. The second reason why it's stupid to be surety for a friend is it's a good way to lose a friend if he can't pay. If you co-sign for your friend's mortgage and your friend can't pay, are you going to be friends anymore? No, I doubt it. I wouldn't be. And thirdly, it's a good way to get sued or killed if you don't have the money to pay your friend's debt if he defaults. Imagine if you co-sign, you strike hands, and then something happens to you and you get sick or you lose your job and now you can't pay, and then your dumb friend defaults and now you can't pay. And now what happens? Well, it depends on if it was a professional institution or not. You might just go into bankruptcy. If it was a loan shark, you may get your legs broken or worse. It was a really, really, really bad idea to co-sign for anybody. Now, if a man that becomes surety for a friend is stupid, then a man that becomes surety for a stranger is exceedingly stupid. It's bad enough to do it for a friend or a child, but for a stranger, you are a certified idiot. A friend will be more likely to be sure to pay his debt so that you're not left on the hook for it, but a stranger has little to no incentive to pay because he doesn't know you and he's likely never going to deal with you again. Can you imagine just walking up and there's two guys on the street, you don't know either one of them, and they're negotiating and the guy says, hey, I'll buy that car off you for $10,000. And the other guy says, well, what if you don't pay? And you just walk in and say, hey, it's on me, buddy, don't worry about it. If he doesn't pay, I'll take care of it. I mean, you'd be a total idiot, right? Be surety for a stranger. Who would do that? Apparently people do it, or God wouldn't tell you not to do it, right? I mean, there must be dumb people out there that would do it. Proverbs 11. I don't know if I did. I not read the verse. We're going to get there in just a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I haven't got to the verse yet. Okay. Yeah, we'll get there in just a second. Actually, we'll get there right now. So if you are surety for a stranger, then you'll smart for it. Proverbs 11:15. Proverbs 11:15. He that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it, and he that hateth suretyship is sure. We'll look at the second half of that verse here in a minute. But yes, you are going to smart. You are going to be in pain if you are surety for a stranger. To smart means, when we're speaking of wounds, etc., and that's the primary definition, it is to be a source of sharp pain, to be acutely painful. So you're going to suffer big time, and you deserve to be if you would cosign for somebody you don't even know. So Solomon is trying to spare his son pain here, whether it would be to a stranger or to a friend, either one. Not a good idea. Now, if a man is stupid enough to be surety for a stranger, you better take some collateral from him to hedge against the likelihood that neither he nor the stranger will pay. Because a guy that's dumb enough to be surety for a stranger, he's probably not going to pay either if his guy, his buddy that he doesn't even know doesn't pay. Proverbs 20 and verse 16. As you see, the Bible, especially the book of Proverbs, has a lot to say about being surety. Proverbs 20:16. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. So if you got the guy in that case, now of course you wouldn't just take his garment if it was for a $10,000 loan, but if it was for a smaller thing, if the guy's buying a pair of pants from a merchant, and he doesn't have the money and he wants to make payment, and the merchant says, well, you know, I don't trust you, I don't know you, and then you walk up and say, hey, you know, I'll cover it, don't worry about it. Well, he's going to say, you know what, give me your coat, because I just want to make sure that you're actually going to pay if he doesn't pay, right? So you're taking a piece of collateral, which is what banks do whenever they make loans. They take things for collateral in case the bums don't pay. Now, he that hates and therefore stays away from suretyship is sure. Proverbs 11:15 again. Get to the second half of that verse that we looked at a minute ago. Proverbs 11:15 says, he that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it, and he that hateth suretyship is sure. So if you hate the idea of being surety, if you hate the idea of co-signing for somebody else, in other words, you are sure. And sure means free from or not exposed to danger or risk, not liable to be injured or destroyed, safe or secure, in other words. So it's always a safe bet to not be a guarantor of another person's debt. You're always sure, you're always safe if you don't do that. Now, maybe you'll feel a little guilty if somebody's really trying and whining and crying on your shoulder and wanting you to co-sign for them because I can't get this car, or I can't get this house, or I can't get this cell phone, or I can't get whatever. But you know what? Follow the Bible and say no. And I will explain to you why right now, presently, that I can think of basically no situation where you should co-sign. You're like, well, you know, what if it's my kids and what if they don't, you know? I'll give you every reason here. Or not, maybe not every reason. I'll give you reasons why I can't think of a situation why you should co-sign. It should be a very rare situation that you should even consider being surety for someone else, even if he's family. So a person should not be going into debt for anything with the, and this is my principle anyway, I think this is pretty sound wisdom, but a person should not be going into debt for anything with the exception of buying a house or starting a business. And even that should be avoided, if at all possible. Now, I realize houses are very expensive today. It's pretty hard to do that. It is possible. I mean, if I would have been working as an engineer for the last 8 years, I could easily have a house right now in cash. No problem. No big deal at all. And I wasn't making crazy money. I was just making decent money. I could have easily bought a house with cash by now. But, you know, I wasn't married for a lot of that time either. I didn't have kids and all that. I mean, you get married at 20 years old and you have kids. And, yeah, it's going to be pretty darn hard, if not impossible, to pay cash for a house. So, I think that's something where you can make an exception. Or possibly starting a business. And the reason is, and I'd still recommend not doing that, if possible, to save up money and start a business when you can. But a lot of times, if you're in manufacturing or something, you have to buy a very expensive piece of equipment, but it's going to pay itself off in a few years. That makes sense, right? Buying a depreciating asset like a car or like anything else on debt is stupid, because it's just, you're losing money on that every month, whereas your piece of equipment is gaining you money every month. It'll pay itself off. The car doesn't pay itself off. It's just an albatross around your neck if you have a loan on it. All other items, including cars, home maintenance, home upgrades, appliances, tools, equipment, furniture, four-wheelers, motorcycles, boats, other toys, all that stuff should be paid for in cash, every bit of it. I do not believe that anything outside of a house or a business should be taking a loan out for anything. And if the person doesn't have the cash to pay for something, then he can't afford it, and he shouldn't be buying it, including a car. And, you know, if, like all of you, you've been under my teaching for 7.5 years, so none of you at this point should have a car loan, because I've been telling you for 7.5 years how to not have a car loan. You just, 5 years, you pay that thing off, and when you're done in 5 years, like let's say your car loan was $300 a month, right? So you pay that thing off for 5 years, and then you take that $300 a month, and you put that in a separate bank account every month, and you make the payment to yourself. And in 5 more years, and you can make your car last 5 more years. Heck, mine's 20 years old, right? If I can do it, anybody can. So you drive that car for 5 more years. You make that payment for 5 more years. And then at the end of 5 years, you have $18,000 in the bank, 300 times 60 months, $18,000 in the bank. And then if you need another car, there you got your 18 grand, you buy another car. And then what do? You keep putting that $300 in the bank. You make the payment to yourself. And now you can go, since you don't have the loan to make for the first 5 years, now you can make that whole payment to yourself for 10 years. And then at the end of 10 years, guess what? You have $36,000 in the bank. Now you could buy a nicer car if you wanted to, or you could just save that money and not. But it's, you know, there you go, and so on. There's no reason for anybody to ever have a car payment if you've heeded this instruction after 5 years. No reason. And if you do, well, that's on you. You just haven't paid attention to good teaching, in my opinion. So anyway, if you can't pay for something in cash, you can't afford it, and you shouldn't buy it. And therefore, you certainly should not be surety for a loan for any such thing. It'd be stupid, in my opinion, to be surety for a loan for something that a person shouldn't be buying anyway, because they should have the cash saved up for it. You know, being surety for a cell phone, or being surety for a couch, or being surety for a car, or anything like that. No, why would you? You should be paying cash. That person should be paying cash for that, and you're just helping him to continue in his foolishness if you're going to co-sign for him, and he's never going to learn how to save money and pay cash for things. So if a man wants to finance a house or a business startup, which is something that you actually might, you know, need to finance, the bank will determine if he's creditworthy, right? And if he's not creditworthy, then they won't give him the loan. And if they won't give him the loan, you would be a fool to be surety for a loan that the bank would not give a guy because he's not creditworthy. Why would you be surety for a guy that the bank won't even trust giving a loan to? You'd be nuts to do that. And if the bank's dumb enough to give him a loan, but he can't afford the down payment, then you'd be a fool to loan it to him. And I've actually known people that couldn't even afford the down payment on the house, let alone the house, and they had to borrow or have somebody give them the money for the down payment on the house. Which is like, if you can't afford the down payment, you certainly can't afford the house, right? So you'd be nuts to be surety for a down payment or to give a down payment to somebody.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So he that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. Could it also be that that stranger is actually acquainted to your friend and your friend just recommended you to him?
Could be, yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
During that time.
Yeah.
So.
Which, yeah, you'd still be crazy to do it.
Yes.
But yeah. Okay. Yeah. And more than likely, that's probably how it would happen.
Mm.
Right? You, like I said, who would just walk up to a guy in the street they don't know? It'd probably be somebody referring, hey, this guy, he really needs help. Why don't you co-sign for him? You know, and so, yeah, bad idea. If you want to help a guy like that, sit him down and say, okay, let's go through your budget. Let's make you a budget. Go line by line. Let's see where you're spending all your money. And let me show you how to save money. Let me show you how to budget. And I've told you this before. And if somebody won't do that, well, don't give them any money, right? If they don't want to lay bare their finances to you, well, go to somebody else and help them help you then. And then he goes on to say in verse 1, second half of the verse, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger. So in this case, there are three, and in every surety case, there are three parties involved when a man becomes surety for another. In this case, there's the first guy, that's the friend, that's in debt or wants to go in debt. If thou art surety for thy friend, he said there in 6:1. And then secondly, there's Solomon's son, who has agreed to be surety for him. So you get the second party there, the guy that's going to be the guarantor. And then thirdly, you have the stranger who is the lender. So that's the three parties involved. Solomon's son is being warned against striking hands with a stranger to be the guarantor of his friend's debt. He's not striking friends with, or not striking hands with a friend. He's striking hands with the bank, essentially, the lender. Now, people strike hands when they become a surety. Job 17 and verse 3. Job 17 and verse 3. Like I said, now, this is really interesting. Job is the oldest book of the Bible as far as when the books were written. Right? The events of Genesis obviously precede Job, but as far as at the time when they were written, Job is the oldest book. So this is going back thousands of years, probably at least 4,000 years. I'd say the Law of Moses was written 1,500 years before Christ, and Job, I'm not sure exactly when, but it could have easily been written around 2,000 years before Christ or so. So you're talking at least 3,500 or 4,000 years ago. So people have been shaking hands, making deals for probably 3,500 to 4,000 years, and probably a lot longer than that. Probably goes right back to, wasn't Cain and Abel. He didn't shake hands. He whacked him over the head or something. But anyway, it goes back a long ways. Job 17 and verse 3. It says, lay down now, put me in a surety with thee. Who is he that will strike hands with me? See, when you're surety, you strike hands. And to strike hands, like I said, means to shake hands. Had to go the whole way down to number 69 in the definition of strike to find the phrase strike, to strike hands. It is said of two parties to a bargain. To take one another by the hand in confirmation of a bargain. Hence, to ratify a bargain with another, hence to strike one's truth. That's another phrase that's used with this. To strike one's truth, to pledge one's truth by striking hands. So when you strike hands, you take another by the hand. In other words, you shake hands. I wondered, I don't remember how long ago, but I wondered what this striking hands was thing. Because when you think of strike, you kind of think of hitting. But when you think about it, when you do shake hands, you are striking hands, right? They're hitting each other, coming together, and you're, you know, shaking them. So giving one's hand is a confirmation of a promise. Look at the book of Ezra 10 and verse 19. Ezra 10:19. Like I said, this is ancient. Ezra 10:19. It says, and they gave their hands that they would put away their wives, and being guilty, they offered a ram of the flock for their trespass. This is whenever they'd married the foreign women of the land, and Ezra was really upset about this. And he pulled his own hair out and got mad at them and told them that they needed to put away these wives. And so these men, gave their hands. In other words, they shook hands and promised that we're going to put these wives away. And then shaking hands is also a confirmation of a covenant. Ezekiel 17 and verse 18. I thought this was pretty neat. I guess I just like whenever I see modern customs found in the Bible and you realize that these modern customs actually aren't modern, that they're very old. I just think this is pretty neat. Ezekiel 17 and verse 18. It says, seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, when lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape. So he, when he had obviously made a covenant, he gave his hand making the covenant, right? And that's how we still do things today sometimes. Usually today there's a lot of paperwork and things, but a long time ago, people would make a deal and they just shake hands on it. And that was just as binding as a signed contract. And it should be. A handshake should be honored with the same commitment as a signed contract. So you want to be really careful when you shake hands and agree to do something. You don't do that flippantly. I mean, when you shake hands and you tell somebody you're going to do something, you do it. I mean, it's bad enough if you tell somebody you're going to do something, you ought to do it. But if you shake hands, you really ought to do it.
Just like the owner of, just like in the movie, The Founder. What's his name?
Zuckerberg?
The owner of The Founder.
Oh, The Founder. I'm thinking of the other one. Oh, yeah, Ray Kroc.
Yeah, he shook their hands.
But yes. Yeah, and he still screwed them. Screwed yeah. them. Yep. Yeah, that's why, especially in today's day and age, it's good to get it on paper. But, yep.
Why did they take off the shoe in the Old Testament? Was that just if they sold something more
that
than
was,
an agreement, they would take off their shoe and give it to the other guy?
Yep, that it was a custom. Abraham did that in Boaz. Yeah. Yep. That was I have read about that. It was just an ancient custom in Israel, and I think maybe in other nations too. Just a symbol. I don't really know what the symbol meant, taking the shoe off, but yeah, that was, and then put your hand under my thigh was another one. Yeah, they would do that too. Yep. Now, striking hands can be done for good or for evil. Proverbs 11:21. Just like almost anything can be done for good or evil. Proverbs 11 and verse 21 says, though hand join in hand, in other words, shaking hands, the wicked shall not be unpunished, but the seed of the righteous shall be delivered. So even though the wicked take each other by the hand and make a deal, they're not going to go unpunished. Or if you think about sometimes when people are walking together, they're walking hand in hand. Even if they're walking hand in hand and they're the best of friends and they've got this plan together and they're going to be there for each other, they're not going to go unpunished, right? The Lord, he's not going to have that. Sooner or later, it'll catch up with him. So therefore, we should think very carefully before shaking a man's hand and agreeing to do something, because that's a solemn commitment. And especially think very carefully before you shake hands and be surety, be a co-signer for somebody else's debt, because it's not a good idea, and we'll spend the next week or two going through these next few verses showing you why that is, and maybe you have. Maybe you're in the position right now, I don't know what you guys have done, but maybe you have co-signed for somebody, I don't know. Well, if you have, well, good, I'm glad you haven't, but maybe somebody has. If you have, well, I'm going to show you from the Scripture how you can minimize your risk of being on the hook. You can't get out of it, but you can minimize your risk. And this is really interesting stuff. I wish we could do it tonight, but we
Pastor
can't. So we'll have to do that later.
Don't you know someone who co-signed for a church member?
I do.
What do you think about that?
Well, I thought it was very kind of the person, mm-hmm. and helpful, and it turned out okay for him. Mm-hmm. And, right. You know, the person was a brother in Christ and all that. And yeah. So I think it was a wise idea, and would I do it myself? No, probably not. Would I have advised to do that? I don't think so based on this verse, but I do think it was a kind thing to do to help the person out, which.
But you wouldn't advise.
I've got too many verses in the Bible that say to not do that. So I wouldn't advise it. But.